the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Well, our first guest has devoted his life to the conservation of our oceans and the marine life in it. Indeed, his life has been about as colourful and varied as the fish in the ocean. His work has taken him from the Galapagos Islands to a convent in rural Ghana to Carna in the west of Ireland, and all for the love of the tiny seahorse. Keelan Doyle, also known as the Seahorse Man, you're very welcome to the programme. An extraordinary kind of connection with seahorses. You grew up along the coast in Port Marnock. Was that where there was a bit of an influence with the sea and marine life?
I suppose, Richard, there was, in the sense that, you know, Port Marnock back then was a very small, rural, almost farming town. And the beach was kind of part of our life. My parents were very much outdoor people, and literally every day of their lives they were down the beach. And, you know, it's funny when I think back, I mean, I was probably 4 years of age and we'd arrive down the beach and they'd walk the full length of the beach with the dog, and I'd stay up in the rock pools, and I used to spend hours just examining the rock pools and the amazing things that you find. And I suppose nowadays, if you're to leave your four-year-old kid on the beach on their own examining rock pools, you'd be charged. But back then, that was life, and it was a happy life.
And there was a lot to see, obviously, that kept you going, because you became so interested in it. You were actually breeding fish at a very early age.
Yeah. I started breeding fish. I mean, literally at 4 years of age, I had fish, basic sort of fish, and I was breeding them. And I think it was last year, I was at a school reunion, and the teacher was telling a story that I arrived in late one morning, and of course she went to, you know, reprimand me, and I told her in a very innocent way that my fish had just had babies, miss. And as she said, how could you scold a young child after that? Because that's literally what I did from as early as I can remember. All I wanted to do was breed and keep fish.
The rest of us were on the dog ate my homework. You had something a little bit more interesting to say. And what about the seahorse, which has obviously been a particular fascination for you? Do you remember the first time you saw one?
I do, actually, and it's a clear memory. My mum was doing the census enumeration, and I always remember with her paycheck she bought our first television, and you can imagine the excitement. And I think the second programme that we watched was a Jacques Cousteau Under the Sea marine biology programme, and there was a seahorse, and I thought this was a mythical animal. This was something part of ancient myths and legends. And I can still, nearly 50 years later, I can still remember the excitement of seeing my first seahorse, believe it or not.
And you've brought in some marine life here. You've got a couple of seahorses there, and you've got some, I always think of the film Nemo, clownfish, is it?
Yeah, and I know people can't see, but just to give you a sense, I mean, everything I have here are creatures that we breed. Everything that I have here is creatures from the ocean and creatures that are under threat in the ocean. So you've got the seahorse, you've got the clownfish, aka Nemo, and you've got corals. So all of these are animals that we now actually cultivate.
And coral is something that you have been involved in protecting and growing as well, and we can talk about that a bit later. But what is it about the seahorse, Keelan, that fascinates you? And what's so unusual about them?
I think, Richard, when you look at them, they're different than anything else. I mean, they're prehistoric. They actually go back to the time of dinosaurs. They kind of are a mixture of animals. They have a head of a horse. They have a tail that can hold on like a monkey. The male has a pouch like a kangaroo. And they have eyes that can look forward and back at the same time, like a chameleon. So they're such an unusual animal. And I think it's the unusualness of them that is something that makes them so special. And a lot of my work now would be evolved around kids' education. So when you bring these animals out to kids, you know, and excuse the pun, you get them hooked. You get them hooked by how beautiful they are. You get them hooked by the fact that it's the only animal in the whole world that the male and not the female has the babies. They dance together every morning of their lives. And they're completely pair bonding. They're monogamous for life. They stay together for life.
And you're obviously in the business of selling aquariums and things now. But if I went into your house, Keelan, have you got wall-to-wall fish tanks and seahorses instead of plasma televisions?
I don't have a TV, believe it or not, but I have every kind of fish that you can imagine. I live up the mountains and I breed everything from fish to emus to wallabies to miniature donkeys to sheep to goats. Animals are my thing.
So you're a busy man.
Yeah.
And it was inevitable, I suppose, with that interest and background in fish that you went to college, you went to Galway to study marine biology.
Yeah, exactly.
And you were very young going to university.
I was 16 doing the leaving, and I headed off on my merry way, probably too young, but I suppose full of the joys, full of the excitement.
You must have started school early.
Yeah, yeah. When I was in school in Portmarnock, at the time the principal called around to the house and said that they were going to lose the teacher. Such was how small Portmarnock was at the time. And if there was any chance I could come to school, I could start school a year and a half early, and that I would stay back at some point down along the line. But of course, you meet friends and you get on with life, and you know, I never stayed back. So
it was a bit like someone saying, "We're short a man for the team match.
Yeah.
Will you tug out?"
Tug out.
You were starting school at a very early age then.
You know, and I was extra small at the same time, so I was always the little kid on the street sort of thing.
Now, after college, you went to Africa. How did that come about?
It's an interesting one, because I was based in Galway, and then I did my master's in Aberdeen, and I met a guy in Aberdeen who was aware of a part of Ghana that was going to be flooded by the Americans for hydroelectric power. And this area had never, ever been studied before from a scientific point of view. And he wanted to raise money to go out there and carry out a study. And I went on RTE many, many, many years ago, went on the Pat Kenny radio show at the time. And from that interview, we raised money to fund the trip and essentially went out there and identified 46 different new species that had never been found in this area, including species of catfish that had never been found in Africa before. And so much so that it actually stopped to this day the Americans going ahead with the damming of this area.
You got very sick while you were there.
I did. It was a very, very remote place. I mean, I was the second ever foreigner that this remote, you know, village had ever seen. And the only foreigner previous to me were Japanese scientists who got killed by the hippos in the areas. So all of a sudden, this redhead Irishman arrived into town, and it was...
Said, "I'm not going near the hippos."
And there was great excitement. But ultimately, I got badly sick. And I actually got the last rites when I was in Ghana. They didn't think I would make it.
But was it an infection or?
I had several things. The main problem, believe it or not, was my appendix was burst for 3 weeks. So I had severe peritonitis. But in the areas of West Africa where we are, or where I was, you don't go to a doctor, because everything is corrupt and the doctor will operate you and take a kidney or what have you. So you're warned above everything not to go to the doctors. And it was at the time I was up near Timbuktu in Mali when it happened. And I eventually got back down into Abidjan. I was held captive by the police in Cote d'Ivoire because they wanted money. Everybody just wants money over there. And luckily, this school teacher...
I'm sure it was probably very widespread at that time, that whole question.
It's probably a lot better. But I was eventually brought to a military hospital in Ghana, and a soldier doctor there essentially saved my life. And an Irish nun at the time heard that I was in the hospital and came and took me under her wing.
And you were in recuperation then were you a long time?
I was in recuperation initially in the hospital, and then I moved out into the convent, and I stayed with this amazing nun, Sister Maura O'Driscoll. She's since passed away from Cork. and she looked after me, and I stayed in the convent until eventually I was fit enough to come back to Ireland.
Did you keep contact with her afterwards and years later?
I did. I mean, we became great friends, and of course this was pre-email and social media days, but she used to write me these amazing letters. And eventually, years later, when I won an award with the Seahorses, and an entrepreneurial award, and it made TV coverage all over the world, and the nuns in Ghana were watching the main evening news in Ghana, and at the end of the news the business section came up, and then there was a profile on myself, and of course the nuns, as far as they were concerned, all their prayers had been answered, and you know, they were delighted. And she eventually came back to Ireland to die, and I got to spend some time with her down in Cork before she passed away.
Oh, all those years later.
Yeah.
And after Ghana, you went to, was the Galapagos Islands?
Went to the Galapagos Islands, yeah.
What was that like, or what were you doing there?
So the Galapagos Islands are the remotest inhabited islands in the world. They're 1,000 miles off Ecuador. And I was looking at the effects of El Nino, which is this huge weather phenomenon, on seahorse populations. So it was an amazing job. I mean, it was diving the 46 islands in the Galapagos to look and see what the effects of El Nino was having. So you were getting to see parts of the Galapagos that had never been dived before. And most of the animals in the Galapagos are only found there. They're endemic to this area. So from a marine biologist perspective, this was the Mecca. This was heaven to be there.
And along the way, while you're travelling and abroad for all those years, the seahorse was still very prominent in your mind as something that you were particularly interested in, and you wanted to do something with seahorses, to breed them, to develop a business essentially as well, back in Ireland. So you came back to do that.
Yeah, I suppose I was kind of part conservation focused, and there was definitely an entrepreneurial part to me that I didn't realise, being honest with you. I mean, there was no business background in my family, and the obvious thing was that seahorses were under threat of extinction. They're used in traditional Chinese medicine. They're used as natural aphrodisiacs. They're more expensive than gold. So the demand for seahorses is increasing, and the wild populations are being decimated. So first of all, there was a huge conservation need. And I had travelled around the world looking at various attempts to breed the seahorse, and none of them had succeeded. So my research was focused in Australia at the time, and I managed to discover what the seahorses were eating in the wild, the baby seahorses. And it was plankton, microscopic plankton, tiny animals. So I came up with this idea that if I could put baby seahorses in the wild, that they would feed off the natural plankton in the water. The problem is, in these coral areas, there's not much plankton there because it's used up by the coral systems. But on the west coast of Ireland, we have the Gulf Stream. We have a massive natural resource of plankton. So I decided that the west coast of Ireland was the place to come back and try and be essentially the first person in the world to breed the seahorse.
So you set it up, you made it happen, and you know it was an opportunity that garnered a lot of publicity as well, because when you got it going in Carna, you were on all kinds of media internationally.
It went wild, Richard, and again, it's probably a great lesson in business, because it was the cart before the horse. It was the worst thing that ever happened. And you know, because I wasn't ready. So I entered this competition, and it was the Entrepreneur of the Year. And if you got to the last 100, you got business training. And as I said previously, I had no business training, no family background. So I had this hope that maybe I could get to the last 100. And of course, won the Young Entrepreneur of the Year. And it just went crazy. I mean, I had ABC. Now, like it's this tiny little village in Connemara in Cairn, an amazing place. You know, you had Reuters, ABC. I mean, we had the Richard and Judy show flying over.
Oh, you really did arrive, Richard and Judy.
They arrived in town in Carna. You know, it was all over the world. I mean, like as I said, in Ghana. And not only did it attract the media, but it then attracted investors.
So what's wrong? That's fantastic. Where's the bad news?
The bad news is that I suppose you had inquiries looking for seahorses and stuff from all over the world, and you know, you weren't ready. Investor wise, I suppose I was at a point where, you know, you were cracking the breeding, everything was going well, it was being funded by Uddaross na Gaeltachta, and everything was going really, really good. What happened was then we had all the top investors, all the big names in Ireland. I mean, one humorous story, for example, Tony Ryan flew down in his helicopter. He was very interested. And the day he flew down to see me, of course, Carna is very much bog and rock, and there's not really anywhere for the helicopters to
land. Not too many helipads to choose from.
The only place that he could land was the football pitch. But the local team, Carna Cashel, were playing a league match. So we had to stop the GA match so he could land his helicopter and he could come down and see the seahorses. But ultimately,
I thought that only happened in Cross McGlen.
No, it happened down in Connemara. And I ultimately went. So we had all the big, big, big guys came down, and I went with an individual who came on board, and I suppose he was very high profile, and he very much changed the direction of the company. And I mean, the banks and everybody at the time were like, listen, whatever he says, you do, sort of thing. And people might remember we had a seahorse tank in Dublin Airport with Waterford Crystal, whose logo was a seahorse. Waterford Crystal wanted to have a tank in every state in America. We had one in Marshall Fields in Chicago. We had Harrods in London. So things were really starting to move.
So you had this opportunity and this momentum behind you, but it was about being ready and about getting that right. And either way, it didn't work out, and you found yourself broke, essentially.
I found myself, so the investor took us down a different direction, and it was to stop breeding, to have this big international launch in a year's time. We had Posh and Beck's, we had Dolce & Gabbana, like it was a real international global launch. But it took about a year, and even though we had signed our investment deal, we didn't get our funding in. So a year later, the crash happened, and our investor was one of the first to go bang. And as a result, because we hadn't got our money, he went bang, and then I went bang. And it was just an amazing lesson that one minute you're all over the front page of every national newspaper and radio and international, and in the blink of an eye, you'd gone bust. And I mean bust.
And this was happening across the board to people, so many business people who found themselves in what they felt was a very strong position, overexposed, or the economic crash that happened and the financial crash, and we know all about it, it was difficult. But for you, you ended up back in Dublin, in Ballymount, and struggling, really.
I ended up in Dublin. A friend of mine had a unit, and he said to me, listen, there's a really small room I'm not using, not even as big as this studio. And I literally, Richard, moved in. It was a concrete floor, and I lived in that room for 2.5 years. And it was amazing. I mean, I hadn't a penny. But at the time, people were giving away fish tanks because of the crash and costs and what have you. So I started picking up these. I didn't know what to do. I really didn't know what to do. But obviously, I had commitments, I had family and everything. And I started picking up these free fish tanks online and started getting a few fish, breeding a few fish. And it was amazing. The word just went out that there was this crazy marine biologist sleeping on the floor in a unit in Ballymount, and he won't sell you fish until he tests your water and uses his microscope and what have you, because that's the training that I had. And people just started coming, and it was an old wooden door, and you have to knock on the door. And people, Richard, were just incredibly generous. I mean, the people from the Tala area, the Clondalkin area, like I couldn't compliment them enough how helpful they were to me. Builder lads who'd sort of say, listen, I've a load of offcuts from a job, I'm not doing anything Saturday, do you want me to build you a load of shelves? Another lad to do it, all free of charge.
Brilliant.
All generous, free of charge.
And at a time when you must have been personally feeling very low, trying to rebuild, trying to do something different, sometimes to get that kind of help from the outside means so much.
And I think you hit the nail on the head. It wasn't just the help. It wasn't the financial. I think it was the fact that I felt somebody was putting that arm around me. And it's something I'll never forget, genuinely never forget. And you know, we now have over 30 staff, and all of the staff are ex-customers of the shop, because these are people who started to call in.
Because they were interested.
And they were interested.
And you've expanded then, because that was one unit and you were sleeping on the floor there and you gradually built it. And then you've expanded then into several units with all of those staff.
So the same landlord owned the whole premises, and one by one, the other businesses went bang during the crash. And it was the same sort of procedure where I'd say to the landlord, listen, I don't have the money to take on the next room, but how about you give it to me for 6 months? He couldn't find a tenant. See if I can turn it into a business. And in 6 months, we do a deal. And I think there's 16 units, and one by one, we've ended up renting the whole lot from the landlord. And, you know, we've become extremely close friends as a result.
And the business has gone really well. Who's buying?
So we started off with Seahorses, and ultimately it then became a fish shop, which would supply every kind of fish, both breeding fish and selling fish, you know, corals, etc., etc. We then moved into the aquariums and the manufacture of the aquariums. Nobody in Ireland was building tanks. Then moved into the aquarium maintenance. And if you look at it, for example, I mean, we'd have 7 guys on the road full time just maintaining fish tanks. So, like, to give you an example, Tallaght Hospital has 16 fish tanks, Temple Street 14. So everything from restaurants, businesses, commercial owners, you know, domestic houses,
it's
everything.
Really taken off. Internationally, outside of Ireland, you're doing all of that, and you've done that, and that's a busy business. And you're selling abroad as well, aren't you?
Yeah, so we would sell. So, for example, with the tanks and with the products, so we would export, you know, any of the fish that we breed. We also have an interesting one, believe it or not, people may enjoy this one, where we export Irish seawater. Irish seawater, believe it or not, has been proven. We have found a location on the west coast of Ireland where the seawater has been identified independently as the highest quality seawater anywhere in the world.
Highest quality based on cleanliness, plankton?
Based on all of the above. Based on mineral content, plankton, bacterial content. And the whole idea is that if you have a marine fish tank, you want the best water for your tank. So we would export this now, for example, to the UK and beyond.
And people are interested in it. Tell me about Saudi Arabia. You're involved in a project there.
Yeah, so it was a mad one. I thought it was spam, to be honest with you. I got contacted by the Saudi Arabian government, and they were very interested in talking to me. They had seen, so we have a documentary on Netflix, and the Saudi Arabian government had watched the documentary, The Seahorse Man. And they realise, I suppose, that the oil is not going to be there forever. And I think they're very cleverly looking at alternatives. And they want to go down the ecotourism route. I suppose, essentially, they want to outcompete Dubai. That's their whole focus. And as part of that, they want to regenerate or rewild an area of the ocean the size of Belgium. So this is something that's never been done before. And
It's not something we would automatically associate with Saudi Arabia.
Totally not.
As a big oil production.
Totally not. Their track record wouldn't be great. But they want to bring this area the size of Belgium back to the way the ocean was before humans existed. So to that level of quality, which has never been done before. And the interesting part for me is it turns out that the Prince of Saudi, who's the wealthiest man in the world, his favourite animal in the whole world happens to be the seahorse. So his focus is the seahorse.
Specifically on that. The seahorse, Keelan, as you're talking about it there, are there many in Irish waters?
So there's 2 species found in Ireland, and we carried out surveys of them. So they're predominantly found in the warmer areas around Cork, Kerry, Connemara. They've been found in Dublin Bay back in the 1800s. There was a seahorse found off Bray about 8 months ago. So they are here.
But that would be unusual.
It would be unusual.
Possible, but unusual.
It would be unusual.
And if someone was to to find them or come across them, how far out from shore, what sort of depth?
They tend to be quite close to shore because they live in sort of seaweedy seagrass areas. So they tend to be kind of found closer near shore, but they're very good at camouflage. I mean, you can imagine trying to find a seahorse there when you look at them in an area of seaweed. I mean, we will often go diving for them and you'll swim right past them and not see them. That's how they survive. It's not getting seen.
We have a text in from Elma, and she's wondering, do you eat fish?
Good question. I eat fish that are not under pressure. So I do eat fish is the answer, but I eat fish that are not endangered, are not threatened. So fish that are in abundance. I mean, you know, anchovies, sardines, for example, hugely nutritious, huge abundance, really good for you. So them I eat, but other ones then I don't.
Eat the right fish then.
Eat the right ones, exactly.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Keelan Doyle of Seahorse Aquariums, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thank you.